The British actor Jason Statham is a former Olympic diver and fashion model who made his screen debut in the 1998 thriller Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Since then, he's gone on to make such movies as The Italian Job, The Bank Job, The Transporter series, and The Expendables, becoming the biggest new action star of the last 10 years. In his new movie, The Mechanic, which co-stars Ben Foster, he plays a professional hitman. Our critic at large, John Powers, says it offers a revealing look at Statham's distinctive appeal.
A few years ago, I was interviewing a well-known Hollywood actress. At one point, she leaned across the table and said, "Did anyone ever tell you that you look just like Steve McQueen?" Well, no, actually, not even close. But even though I knew she was working me, I was secretly flattered. I mean, any guy, and especially a critic, would enjoy being compared to McQueen. You see, he embodied a very seductive male fantasy. The quiet, effortlessly virile hero who seemed to have emerged from the womb on a motorcycle. McQueen could bluff at poker, hotwire a car, and wield a gun without making a fetish of its size. Who wouldn't want to be like that? One who's clearly trying is Jason Statham, the British action star best known for B-movies like the Transporter series, who may inspire more absurd man-crushes than any other current screen actor. If you've never seen him, you could do worse than his new movie, The Mechanic. It's a brisk, highly watchable 92-minute thriller based on a 1972 movie starring another manly man, Charles Bronson. Statham plays Arthur Bishop, a crack hitman who lives in a sleek house on the Louisiana bayou. One of those artistic assassins, like George Clooney in The American, Arthur has only one friend, his mentor Harry, nicely played by Donald Sutherland. But after a big betrayal, Arthur has to kill Harry, and making matters trickier, he finds himself dealing with Harry's angry wastrel of a son, Steve. He's played by Ben Foster, a great young actor who's as explosive as Statham is stony. Steve wants to learn to be a hitman, so Arthur tries to teach this young hothead the cool art of murder. Eventually, the two find themselves bumping up against the movie's villain, a corporate type played by the prissily handsome Tony Goldwyn, who seems destined to star as Timothy Geithner in a TV movie about the Obama years. Here, Arthur phones this baddie in his high-rise lair to let him know the jig is up.
Yes.
How much was Harry's life worth?
$50 million. Harry's death was business, pure and simple.
Well, it's not going to be so simple now.
You think you can get to me before I get to you?
I already have.
Where's conference room E?
Floor upstairs, sir.
He's in the building. Get me out of here.
You're fine, Bishop.
Nothing yet.
Now, part of Statham's appeal is that he's not a Tom Cruise pretty boy or a towering monument like Clint Eastwood. He has a vivid slab of a face that holds the screen, but isn't much of an instrument for conveying emotion. As for his body, although he's pint-sized, he has the physical presence of a ripped six-footer, and he can really move. Statham spends much of The Mechanic slugging, kicking, or throttling people underwater, and we believe it. Then again, all action stars can do action. What makes the biggest ones compelling is that they provide an exaggerated look at a particular aspect of masculinity. For instance, the self-pity in Sylvester Stallone's heavy eyes, or the working-class anger in Bruce Willis's smirking contempt for authority. Statham belongs to the tradition of heroes, from John Wayne through Harrison Ford, who are laconic to the point of grumpiness. Yet it's not his terse toughness that makes him special. Oddly enough, it's his fastidiousness, a don't-touch-me fussiness that runs through nearly all his movies. In The Mechanic, Arthur not only spends his life making algebraically precise preparations for his assignments, but at home, he carefully wipes his LPs. Naturally, he has vinyl, before queuing them up. Hooked on precision and mastery, a Statham character is never more himself than when driving 100 miles an hour, when all that matters is technique and keeping your cool. On the other hand, he's driven crazy by anyone who can't hold it together, be it the unruly Steve, who keeps making a bloody mess of Arthur's immaculately tooled schemes, or the Ukrainian Uber babe from the movie Transporter 3, who violates the sanctity of his souped-up Audi by sloshing down ecstasy with vodka. This coldly relentless focus is one reason Statham's detractors claim he seems more like a machine than a man. In fact, he's less a machine than a mechanic, which is why this new movie is perfectly titled. Statham is always obsessed with doing the job and keeping everything, tools, women, feelings, in their proper place. This obsession with neatness is the true theme of the mechanic and of Statham's persona. It's his code, his religion, his armor. So devoted to his sense of order that he'll kill for it, he incarnates a fantasy of perfect control that taps into something deep in the male psyche, even as it leaves most women rolling their eyes.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
This week, Japan faced yet another economic humiliation. Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agency, downgraded the country. The agency said it's worried about Japan's long-term ability to pay back its debt. Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team explains why this concerns American policymakers.
If you happen to run into Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner or the chair of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, and for some reason you want to terrify them, just start talking about Japan's economy. Frankly, you should probably feel afraid when you hear about Japan's economy. You know, it's this major world economic superpower. It got into a financial bubble. The bubble popped. And 20 years later, the country still can't seem to get itself back on track. Here's a statistic. In 1995, Japan's economy was 7 times bigger than China's. Since then, China's economy has grown a lot. It's now bigger than Japan's. And Japan's economy has actually shrunk. That just doesn't happen with major developed countries. But as its economy was shrinking, Japan's government spent like mad. Its debt is now 2 times as big as its economy, its GDP. Debt twice your income is tough for a person, but for a country, it's almost unthinkable. There's only one country in the world in worse debt shape, Zimbabwe. Those highly indebted countries you keep hearing about, the ones causing global crises like Greece and Ireland, their debt burden is way smaller than Japan's. And the future does not look so bright. Japan's population is unhealthily tilted towards older people, so they have to think about huge pension payments in the coming decades. Now, investors are still lending lots of money to Japan at reasonable rates. The country does not seem to be on the brink of an acute fiscal emergency, but at the same time, it doesn't seem likely to break out of its long-term chronic economic illness. If all of this sounds a bit eerie, a premonition of where the U.S. might be headed, there's reason to be concerned and some reasons not to be so worried. The U.S. certainly has an increasing debt burden, but it's nowhere near Japan's or Greece or Ireland's or many other countries. The U.S. economy is growing slowly, but much faster than Japan's. And while we certainly have all those retiring baby boomers coming, we're not as tilted towards the old as Japan is, especially since we're far more open to immigration. The standard view is that it took an awful lot of really bad decisions by Japanese government and central bank officials to get where they are today. Let's hope that Japan to the U.S. is kind of like Lindsay Lohan to the casual drinker. Not an inevitability, more of a cautionary tale of where things can go when they get out of hand. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
This day, 25 years ago, brought a moment of reckoning for NASA. When the Challenger exploded, it was the first time the U.S. had ever lost astronauts during a flight. Now NASA finds itself at another crossroads. Astronauts may soon be flying not on the shuttle, but on private spaceships. So what might happen if a commercial space company had an accident on the scale of the Challenger? NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
25 years ago today, Space Shuttle Challenger lifted up into the Florida sky.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Suddenly, a nightmare. A huge cloud of smoke, the path of the spaceship cut short. Ed Mango remembers that day. He was an engineer in NASA's Launch Control Center. And later, in 2003, NASA assigned him to recover what was left of Space Shuttle Columbia when it broke up during reentry. He and his colleagues at NASA don't need an anniversary to remind them of those dark days.
Challenger and Columbia are very much part of what we think about this week, if not every week.
Mango now spends his work week planning for a future without the space shuttles. NASA will stop flying them later this year, and Mango heads the Space Transportation Planning Office at Kennedy Space Center. He says by around 2015, it's possible that astronauts could be riding on the outer space version of rental cars, spaceships owned, designed, and built not by NASA, but by private companies. Mango says his number one priority is to make sure those flights are safe.
The responsibility for the mission is still ultimately accountable to NASA. And if the vehicle does not fly right, then we will be held accountable for what has happened.
The agency has been preparing a list of safety standards that a private spaceship will have to meet before any NASA astronaut climbs on board. Some space industry watchers have criticized a draft of these standards as being too burdensome. But former astronaut Ken Bowersox says his company is just glad to finally get them. Bowersox works for SpaceX. An unmanned test version of its capsule has already launched, orbited Earth, and returned as planned. After a number of successful missions carrying cargo, people could be next. Bowersox says just because the SpaceX rocket ship is designed to be cheap, that doesn't mean it won't be safe.
I mean, let's look at a Ferrari and a Honda Civic or a Toyota Yaris. They're greatly different in cost, but would you say that the little economy cars are less safe or more safe than the Ferrari?
Still, any accident would probably result in a long investigation and spaceflights being grounded. Could a private company survive that?
A lot depends on how the private company reacts, and a lot of it depends on the root cause of the failure. But you can imagine that any company in that situation would have a lot of pressure on it.
It's unclear how the public would feel about a major disaster with a private spaceship. John Logsdon is a space policy expert with George Washington University. He says if an accident occurred during some of the first commercial space flights, it might create doubt about whether private companies can really manage the risks of human spaceflight.
But if it's 3 years into a regular service, I think it would be not exactly ho-hum, but more akin to an aircraft accident than a space accident.
After all, these private space companies wouldn't be boldly exploring a new frontier as NASA used to. They'd just be providing a kind of commuter flight to the space station. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
There's a debate raging on the campus of Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn. That's a public, historically black college named for the slain civil rights leader. The college is trying to evict an academic center run by former prisoners, and as Joel Rose reports, the debate is part of a wider split between administrators and the college community.
Medgar Evers led the fight for civil rights in Mississippi.
All we want you to do is keep going with this fight for freedom, and as we stick together here...
His assassination in 1963 inspired songs and demonstrations. 7 years later, educators and community leaders in Brooklyn named a new college in his honor.
Our mission is dedicated to upholding the work that he did and the activism surrounding that.
Brenda Green has taught English at Medgar Evers College for 30 years. Today, the school serves 7,000 commuter students, including many who are not traditional undergraduates. Green describes the college as a communiversity, with an extra emphasis on the community part.
It's a university, it's a college, but it's a communiversity. You can't separate those parts.
Yet that's exactly what some community members accused the school's president and provost of doing since they came to power in 2009. The new administration has pushed for a lot of changes, none more controversial than the decision to evict a criminal justice center run by the formerly incarcerated.
This is not just a purely academic institution, but it's also a brain trust.
Divine Pryor is the co-founder of the Center for New Leadership on Urban Solutions, which has been based at Medgar Evers College since 2004. The center describes itself as an advocate for former prisoners, both on campus and in policy debates about the nation's criminal justice system. But the new administration was not impressed. Last month, Medgar Evers College Provost Howard Johnson moved to evict the center.
My goal clearly as chief academic officer is to make sure that we have the highest academic standards for our students. And I didn't think they reached the level of the rigor that I would be looking for an academic center.
College officials point out that none of the center's staff are on the faculty at Medgar Evers College. They've also raised questions about the credentials of co-founder Divine Pryor, who got his PhD from an unaccredited distance learning company. But Divine Pryor defends his degree. He says it's college administrators who are being dishonest.
This is about an administration who does not support a progressive, a social, and criminal justice agenda. They have concerns about the criminal element being on campus. These were the actual words that was used by the provost.
Medgar Evers College officials say the formerly incarcerated are still welcome on campus. And just to be sure, they launched a new partnership this month with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office to provide educational support for former prisoners. The Center for New Leadership is fighting its eviction in court. But there are those on the faculty of Medgar Evers who would not be sad to see it go.
Tell you the truth, I never, ever heard of the Center for New Leadership until all this broke out. And I've been here for 13 years, so that says something.
Nancy Lester directs the education department at Medgar Evers College. She says social justice is an important part of the school's mission, but so is good old-fashioned teaching.
This is a college. It's an academic institution. It needs to have everything be part of that. I don't see how anything that's been done by the new administration goes against this mission.
Now the administration will have to make that case in court. A hearing on the Center for New Leadership is set for next month. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. As protesters swarm the streets of Egypt and several other Arab countries, commentator Andre Kadrescu is tempted to draw a parallel to the fall of communism in Europe more than two decades ago. But Kadrescu stopped short of that.
Cell phone, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter video coming out of Egypt and Yemen are as murky and chaotic as the pictures we had coming out of Romania or Warsaw in 1989. What brings people to the streets isn't as important as what happens if they win. In Bucharest in 1989, young people took over state's television and looked for a moment like leaders elected spontaneously to bring an end to the dictatorship. And then the real guys showed up, the generals and the apparatchiks who had been getting ready to seize power. The demonstrators in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, and wherever there is a next are drunk with freedom and ready to die for it. But it's the freedom of being together in a raging mass, the madness of crowds, as Charles Mackay called it in 1841. And what happens when and if they succeed won't look anything like what we are seeing on the web and on TV. In the bipolar world of 1989, the media broadcast dutifully images of the visible struggle, but those images didn't add up to a neat story of a communist demise and capitalist triumph. The scenes we are seeing in Tunis, Yemen, and Egypt in the schizophrenic teens of the millennium won't add up to a simple story of the triumph of democracy and new media over tyrants and state-controlled news either. In Romania before 1989, they used to say that it was a country blessed with everything: oil, gold, good soil, and great weather, just like Switzerland. The only problem, Romanians weren't Swiss. In Cairo in 2011, just like in Bucharest in 1989, it took guts to imagine a different world. In Europe, that world came eventually, and it was a lot better than the one before. Let's hope the same thing happens now.
Andre Kadrescu covered the revolution in Romania in 1989 for this network.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
That means it's time for this month's episode of Science
Diction, where we talk about the origin of science words with my guest, Howard Markel, professor of the history of medicine, University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and he's also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
How are you this week?
I'm great. How are you?
We're digging out.
Yeah.
What's our word this week?
Well, the word today is physician.
Physician.
Yeah.
Not doctor.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's almost cliche when you're in a crowded theater and someone takes ill. Someone will say, is there a doctor in the house? But the word doctor is actually a Latin word and later a French one, meaning anyone who's a teacher, usually of law, theology, philosophy, as well as medicine, the four learned professions. So the really precise way to call for medical attention would be to ask for a physician.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it comes from, we have to start with the Latin word physicum or physicus, and later the French word physique, and all of these words mean treatment or remedy. And around 1200, 1212 to be exact, the Anglo-Normans appropriated these words for English to coin the word physic, P-H-Y-S-I-C. And even though it's rarely used today, physic can still be found in any English dictionary to define medicine or remedy.
Yeah, you see it used in old English textbooks and things like that.
Sure, and there's some professorships of physic at medical schools to this very day. But you know, it makes sense that from physic we would get the word physician, and that
right.
meant for centuries a medical practitioner. They were generally university educated, and they prescribed drugs or remedies as opposed to their formerly less distinguished colleagues, the surgeons, who worked with their hands and typically with a knife.
And they two timed as barbers sometimes.
Yeah, well, they often trained under barbers. And
yeah.
You know, I just had a haircut the other day, but I'm glad my barber doesn't bloodlet anymore. But back then they did, yeah.
And so when did the word physician start being acceptable as a doctor sort of thing?
Well, it began to catch on in English as early as the 1200s through the 1500s. And you see it in the Oxford English Dictionary cites dozens of texts that it appears in, including many plays by William Shakespeare, although he liked both the word physician or doctor to describe his medical men. But its most famous entry in the English language occurred in 1522. And that was the year that William Tyndale published the first translation of the New Testament from ancient Hebrew, Greek, and Latin into English. And so when he was translating Luke 4:23, he used the word physician instead of the Latin word medice for the famous axiom, physician, heal thyself. Now, in this particular parable, Jesus returns to Nazareth, and he expects to be criticized by his townsmen with this phrase, which was actually a very common Hebrew axiom, for helping others in faraway places but not in one's own home. And the point of that axiom, of course, is that we should cure ourselves of our own faults before we start correcting those of others.
Very, very interesting. It has a very interesting history to it.
Yeah.
Did you think it did when you were looking it up?
I didn't know quite about the New Testament, but yeah,
yeah.
I had a feeling it had a very interesting history, and it turned out that way, yeah.
All right, Howard, thanks. Thanks for joining us. We'll look forward to your next word.
Thanks so much.
And that's the last word from Howard Markel, who's professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. And that's about all the time we have for this hour. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata, Catherine Wells, and Alessio Bayek. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. And if you missed any part of our program, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We also have a video pick of the week. It's mashup, mix-up. How do they do that? You know, how do they do all that kind of thing? It's great instructional video put together there, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it, created by Catherine Wells. And also, we have our iPhone and Android apps up there, so you can download Science Friday. You can take us with you in your pocket, videos and the audio. So it's there for your enjoyment. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.